like you can call it a bedroom. Mm-hmm. But actually they didn't have beds in the sense that we know beds here, you see?
Uh-huh.
They were just like solid, what do you call this, solid, we used to call it bancos.
Like a cabinet in a way?
Like, yeah, and then put a little back in, you sleep there, no springs or anything, you know?
Uh-huh. Do they have like any padding or anything underneath it?
Some padding, but no, nothing, no springs, you see. No uh-huh. springs, just mostly cotton and
Did any of the families used to live on the floor, not on the platform?
Some of them would, in uh-huh. some cases, but usually they would have this...
platform.
Yeah, we used to call it sofa. Sofa is here is something else, but there was like a raised platform
uh-huh.
and it was ample enough for everybody to, there was no crowding, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so as I told you, the question of the transportation is mostly by foot, if you had to go anywhere.
And barefoot, huh?
Barefoot,
uh-huh.
for those kids. But the men usually would wear sandals or shoes and so on.
Uh-huh.
And then donkey, if you could afford a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I never got around to get a ride in the car because nobody had a car. You know, it was just the Italians.
Uh-huh.
And of course, we told you about incidentally, speaking about the religious things again, like the bar mitzvah. Here, you know, when you have a bar mitzvah, you've attended some of them, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
They just and like weddings, you know, you spend
yeah.
4,000 or 5,000, you know, fortune.
Yeah.
And in Rhodes, by comparison, a bar mitzvah was a very simple thing.
Uh-huh.
The boy reached the age of 13, the father would see to that he would order the tefillin, you know, the lectories from Jerusalem.
So they had to buy it from Jerusalem?
They had to be kosher, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was it, because in Rhodes you couldn't buy those things. And then it had to be from a slaughter cow, you know, it had to be, the leather had to be kosher,
I see.
You know, it had to be slaughtered.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And supervised and all that by the rabbis. So they always played safe by ordering from Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
ahead of time, you know, a year or so. And then they would have the bar mitzvah, like you do here in the temple, only the boy didn't make any speeches, you know.
Yeah.
He just read from the Torah.
Uh-huh.
He read it very fluently,
uh-huh.
you know. And he opened up the Torah, and then he'd go and read the Torah, and then he would say the prayers, you know.
Come on.
And the...
Would there be a celebration?
Yes, and then they would come home. And relatives would come to the house, you know, and they would pass around these sweets, marzipan, baklava, all that sort of thing, this Turkish delight I told you about.
Uh-huh.
And there would be, that's the extent of the celebration, just passing out the, okay. And the kids, of course, the boys, there was no dancing, there was no orchestra like you have here, you know.
Yeah.
It was a very simple thing, very inexpensive. Very inexpensive. And you know, when you start to think what it costs here, you know, bar mitzvah, like
comparison.
A wedding.
Huh? There's no comparison.
Yeah, and these bar mitzvah kids, they wear bow ties and tuxedos and everything. And now that the poor kids, if they have a pair of shoes, they're lucky. Anyway, the thing is that these kids, when they learn Hebrew, they learn Hebrew. So by bar mitzvah, they had to graduate. By that I mean that they had to know all the prayers, everything, because they had to join the older men for the minyan, see? And they had to know their prayers, the silent devotion, you know, that the Amidah, called the Amidah.
Right.
They had to know it by heart. The Shema Israel, you know, we chant in the Kehillah.
Right.
You know, the whole thing they had to memorize. And when they went to bed, they wear a little skull cap and recite the Shema
uh-huh.
in bed before they went to sleep.
Hmm. How about in the morning when you wake up?
Oh yeah, in the morning they have to say the morning prayers. same morning prayer. Where these?
Not every day, though, was it?
Oh, yeah, every day.
Every day?
Sure.
Was this all the people or just the religious ones?
No, all the people. They were supposed to.
But usually
the children, you know, the boys didn't have much time for that because they had to go to school and so on.
Uh-huh.
But the fathers, as a rule, that was a must.
And the boys, they'd learn the stuff for their bar mitzvah in the Talmud Torah, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And once they were had their bar mitzvah, would they keep going to the Talmud Torah after their bar mitzvah?
No, as a rule not, because Talmud Torah was to prepare them for the bar mitzvah.
Right.
See what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And once they finished there, then they continued on as far as the religious education by going to services in the temple.
Uh-huh. Right.
In other words, they're already a graduate.
Yeah.
But here, you see, in this country, they go to the Talmud Torah, they learn their few prayers, and you know, they deliver a speech, you know, my dear father and mother, you broke me, and so on and so forth, which is wonderful. And then after that, they very rarely go to temple, you know, to the
right.
services.
Until
except
they go.
Maybe Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, they go because all the kids go. But during Friday night services, you know, very seldom that they go, unless it's some celebration, some special occasion.
Yeah.
So, but over there it was a must. You know why? First of all, that was their environment. That was the traditions, that was the ritual, and everybody was doing it, and you couldn't be, otherwise you'd be a loner, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You'd be ostracized. You know, you could be called the names too. As being anti-this and anti-religious. So they had to go. And then another thing is because there was nothing else to do. You know, you couldn't go to the stadium, go to a USC football game.
Yeah.
So they didn't have anything like that. And speaking about sports, you know, we had to improvise for our pastime, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Saturday, Sunday for a Saturday or during the week, we want to play games. So we had to create our own games, you know,
uh-huh.
like marbles, like sometimes we take buttons from our shirt to play with, you know,
uh-huh.
or slings, make our own slings, you know,
uh-huh.
to shoot at birds and so on.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, all kinds of crazy kiddish things, or play piggy bank, they call it?
Piggy bank? Yeah.
Yeah.
How often would you go into the water?
Oh my God, that was, we were practically born in the water, you know.
Really?
Yeah, we'd go 3-4 times a week.
Would you swim way out, or?
Yeah, we'd go, there was a shortcut, you see, we used to leave the road,
is
surrounded by wall, high wall, you see.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the gates, there are 3-4 gates, and they close them up a certain time of the evening.
Right.
And if they locked up, then if you were swimming, you can get home, you know, because they, so there used to be a little window through the high wall,
mm-hmm.
and this little window with bars, you know, iron bars, was for the water sewage.
Yeah.
From the community would go, like under a little tunnel, would go to the, through this barred window into the sea, see,
uh-huh.
like sewage.
Yeah.
So what we kids used to do is to break a couple of the bars, iron bar, and then we go right through this big hole, you see?
Uh-huh.
Know what I mean? And then the authorities would come and find that the bars were broken, then they would put new bars and cement, you know. So before the cement would dry, one of the kids would sound the alarm, said, you know what, they just repaired it. And then we would go, the 3 or 4 of us, you pull, I pull, see?
And then
we would just tear the darn thing again, you know. It was the best time to get it before the thing dried, you know, set. And then, so going through this little window with the bars again torn off, with to the shortcut to the community.
Wasn't it dangerous to go under there?
No,
it was pretty safe.
And the tunnel was about, I don't know, 2, maybe a couple of feet, so we used to crawl, you know.
All the way, yeah.
All the way, maybe at the distance of about 20 feet.
Uh-huh.
And here was all this polluted water going through,
yeah,
you know, to the through this little barred window.
And how big was it, how much would the water be?
No, no, it was just like little running water, you know, like a river, you might say. It was much, maybe a foot or something like that.
So like, you had to go through that stuff?
No, it's okay, barefooted, all right. Yeah. So we got home and take a rag and wash our feet, and that's it. You see?
Yeah.
So that's, and that was our, we never allowed anybody to close that window, you know?
Yeah.
And we couldn't close it up altogether because the water had to go through.
Right.
You know what I mean? It had to be a space.
Right.
So just like the prison iron bars, you know?
Yeah.
Broke them up. And anyway, what else would you like to know?
Oh, okay. Okay, one of the things you said was the shofar. How often would they use the shofar? Besides,
the shofar was, the shofar was during the Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, just like we do here.
And that's all? That's all you'd use it for? Except for every once in a while a
trick? Of course, I was talking about the trumpet that the midwives used
in
the homes of a woman that was going to have a baby in order to scare the baby inside, you know, to come out so she could blow into the mother's with a trumpet. It wasn't, it was like a shofar, but it felt like a trumpet. Well, you know,
wasn't it shofar? Is ram? Was it ram's horn?
No,
or something else.
It was something else. It was
the shofar is something very holy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
It was ram's horn, and sometimes the damn thing would she'd blow in the ear so hard the poor woman would be get deaf, you know, burst her eardrum.
Wow.
But that was part of life. Of course, when I remember, as if it were today, I remember when I was about a year or two before we came to the United States, you know. We used to hear about stories about America.
Uh-huh.
You know, weird stories, but we believed everything they told us. But then they would tell us, you know, when you go to America, the streets are all paved with gold bricks. And spoons and forks, everything made of gold. I said, my gosh, I'd like to get some of those forks and knives. And over there, nobody works, you know. Like the money, just all you have to do is shake a tree, and the money comes tumbling down. So as kids, we used to believe all these, you know, our imagination would run away with us. And so anybody said anything, why, it was the gospel truth.
America, was there anything else that was very highly important?
No.
Like Europe or anything?
No, somehow the only thing we ever heard about was America. You know why? Because most of our people that left Rhodes was for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because those that came here first would send letters, oh, come over here. And here, in one day, I make the equivalent of what I make in Rhodes in 1 week.
Yeah.
You know, see, here they would make $2 a week, in Rhodes maybe half a dollar, you know? I mean,
Yeah.
And then here you can eat meat every day. You know, they would write in letters. We have plenty here, milk and butter and chicken if you want to eat every day. Everything is available, plentiful. So the people back in Rhodes get all excited, said, my gosh. And many of them would send their daughters to America and to get married to a son of the family in Rhodes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, they would have sort of a picture bride, you know?
Yeah.
The family would send a picture of the daughter to the next door neighbor's son of the United States, and then he would send his picture, and then first thing you know, okay, I think she's for me. And the mother would, boy, she would be glad to get rid of her because, you know, get rid of the girl, sight unseen, you know? They figure what the boy is from Rhodes, and we know the family, so that's the best guarantee. So she'd come to the United States, meet the man, get married, set up housekeeping, have children, and everything is, and usually it worked. Usually it worked. So I don't see it, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, they just exchange, just like the Japanese do, they exchange pictures, and it's done. See?
Yeah, that's.
And the thing is, here, on the other hand, boy meets girl in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Boy meets girl, They go around for 6 months, a year, and so on.
Yes.
And they think they know each other, you know.
Yeah.
Until they get married, and then they start getting in each other's hair.
Yeah.
Then the first thing they do, make a beeline for, sure, they go to Las Vegas, they get a divorce, and so on. And speaking about divorce, you know, in Rhodes, a lawyer there would starve to death if he depended on divorces, you know, somebody coming to him for a divorce. It's unknown. And here, some of the lawyers, the major part of their income is divorces,
yeah.
You know, they specialize in divorces.
I was wondering, at the Tomo Turah, the boys would go there until they had their bar mitzvah. What about the girls? Do they ever have bat mitzvahs?
No.
Never?
No.
In Rhodes.
I tell you, bat mitzvah is really an innovation of the...
Reform,
Reform, that's right. And over there, are you kidding? A girl to be bat mitzvah, they don't even know the meaning of it.
Yeah, I was thinking.
No,
that's why I wanted to ask.
The thing is, on the boy, everything is on the boy. The girl is secondary, you know,
yeah.
That's the Oriental philosophy. The girl is supposed to sow and all that, get ready for marriage, get ready to settle down, get ready to have children, and to cook.
Uh-huh.
And the master of the house, the man, he's the one that's going to bring home the bacon, not bacon, yeah, I better not say bacon. bring home the bread. The staff of life, you know. And that's the way it was. And I'll tell you one thing. Sometimes I take a philosophical inventory, you know, of life.
Uh-huh.
And I think what was then the old country,
mm-hmm.
we went through all these rigors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know if next day we're going to have a loaf of bread, you know, mm-hmm. because it was sort of a hand-to-mouth existence. You ate today, but tomorrow you don't know what is going to come because by tomorrow there's no more bread, you know.
Uh-huh.
So you're waiting for your father to bring his gunny sack full of a few vegetables, a loaf of bread. And as soon as you come home with his, then you call him gunny sack, don't you?
Yeah,
gunny sack. You open up, see what's in there, just like Santa Claus, you know. you open up your thing, and then you find that he's got some vegetables and a loaf of bread and maybe a few fish, so we're all happy. We're going to have food for tomorrow. And that may sound strange, but the thing is, life there was beautiful. Beautiful in the sense there was a great deal of respect
uh-huh.
of the young towards the parents. You know, no such thing as going out or coming late.
Uh-huh.
That's out. I mean, now you can just forget it. Anybody tried to do that, he would be called crazy, put in a crazy house.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of respect for the grandfathers and grandmothers. You know, they approached them with a certain reverence.
Yeah.
You know, if the grandfather was alive, they'd go kiss his hand, and then the grandfather would put his hand on his, on the boy's head, you know, and bless him and all that. It's a big thing.
Yeah.
And so food we got by somehow, see?
So you like that? You like that style of life, huh?
Well, that was the only. It was really because here, you know, here for instance, you buy a car. No, everybody buys a new car. What's so big about it? So you go to Desmond, you buy a suit of clothes. You don't go around and say, "Hey, look at that. How do you like my suit?" But in the old country, if you were lucky to get a pair of shoes or a pair of pants, you go around shouting from the house, "Hey, look what I got! I got a brand new pair of shoes." See?
Uh-huh.
To you, it was a big thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
And here, we take everything for granted.
Yeah.
See, it was the philosophy of living. People can be poor, you know, in material things, but they can be rich in having spiritual things, in having peace of mind, not a complicated life. You hit the hay, you go to sleep. Here we go to bed and we toss, we're worrying about this, worrying about that, about a million things, it's so hard, what I'm going to do tomorrow, what I'm going to do about this front. There we didn't have anything.
Yeah.
No taxes, no this, no that, everything was, you
right.
see?
Yeah.
And the people were intelligent, and they lived by certain code of ethics,
mm-hmm.
religion, spirituality, home life, home family, and the respect. For the elders, which is something you don't see anymore in this country. I mean,
not too much.
These kids nowadays, they go and they think they know all the answers, and they don't. They're just kidding themselves. And then they get into trouble, you know, with all these pot and LSD and all that and so on, which they get dressed and they and the latest styles and all that, which is all superficial.
Uh-huh.
See, because the older you get, the more you, you appreciate what was the old country like.
Simple things
of life, you know. Yeah. If you take a walk down the street, you enjoy it. Here, you take a walk down the street, you enjoy it. No, you got to get in the car to go to the corner of the drugstore, you know. And so that's why I say the life there was we consider it old-fashioned, but it was the real life, because everything was solid, you know. The foundation was solid. And if you raise the kids, you don't have to worry about them.
Mm-hmm.
And here, if you the minute you start raising children, they get to be 13, 14, 15, then they break away,
right.
You know. Like
right.
The girls, they want to live in an apartment, they want to break away from the family. Here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And over there, the only time they ever left home is when they got married.
Right.
See?
Right.
And, I mean, this, in essence, was, and then, as I said, the Sephardic community was a very thriving community.
Mm-hmm.
And especially under the Italian rule, you know, the island was developed and they did a lot of archaeological findings there, you know, like discovering the Venus of Rhodes.
The Venus?
The Venus.
Venus?
V-E-N-U-S. You know,
what's
there
that?
Is a Venus, you know the statue?
Oh, Venus, yeah.
Venus
yeah.
Of,
yeah.
Of what, in Italy?
Greece.
No, in Italy.
Well,
the Venus of
is,
Milano, isn't it? Which is the one that exists? There is a Venus with the arms.
Yeah. I don't know where it is.
I think it's in Italy.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure, but
there's
anyway.
There's a Greek mythology, though. Wasn't
yeah,
it?
The Venus was the she was the goddess of love, I think.
Mm-hmm, right.
Anyway, Rose they found also a Venus, but with the arms intact, everything intact. You know, she was coming out of, like she was coming out of a bath,
uh-huh.
And her tresses, her long tresses, and so on. But anyway, I say the Italians did a lot of good to the. They brought water into the homes. They brought sanitation facilities. See, during the Turkey rule.
Didn't have a,
they didn't have any toilets, anything like that. Everything was like cesspools, you know, very
uh-huh.
primitive. But still, in spite of that, people
lived happily.
They got away. I don't know how. I think by the will of God, because the Italians they used to the sanitation was very important with them to examine the milk, you know, how much water, if it was infected, if it was from tuberculous cows and stuff like that, and the sanitation problems and the water pollution, all that, with the Italians, you know.
Uh-huh.
And really tremendous. And with the Italians, of course, the Sephardic community prospered more than ever. And the island became such an attraction, it was called the Pearl of the Mediterranean. And the Italians, they had hot water springs.
Yeah, right.
And they had buildings put in there where people could go to take these mineral baths and all that. They used to come from Egypt, from all over the Mediterranean to come to Lourdes for these mineral baths, you know,
okay.
Among other things.
Okay, I have a few more questions.
Oh, you have, go ahead.
Okay, and I have around, I don't know, maybe 15 more minutes on tape. And the rest, if I have any other questions, I'll just write them down. I was wondering, would there be, would the people go to, like, coffee houses in Rhodes?
Oh, yeah, they call them cabanés.
Uh-huh.
Cabanés, coffee houses.
Would they do, like, have music and stuff like this, or just,
oh, they
just
have,
to talk?
No, they have maybe a phonograph with some records,
uh-huh.
But they go mostly to gossip, you know. Over
and the men?
Turkish coffee. I'm talking about the men.
Uh-huh.
Women, no.
Never. Uh-huh.
And then they'll play some... with diet, tabla they call it, you know, looks like it's a Turkish game,
okay.
Like chess, you know.
And also, where would the Jewish people do most of their dancing or their, and hear their music, at weddings only? Or
only at weddings, yeah, in the homes. You see, that they didn't have the Keilah, you know, the temple. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a social hall like we do here at the Hebrew Center, you know? So the weddings were at home, and they had...
the music there.
The music there, they had like a Turkish orchestra, and the violinist, and they said the accordion, and the
flute,
typical Oriental music, you know? And then they stood then La Choro, you know? The Chora,
yeah,
they call
right,
it.
Right.
And then they take a handkerchief, you know, hold it up.
That's
and
Turkish.
Yeah. So they have Turkish and Greek and in the house.
Okay.
And then they would put, you know,
was
money.
That, yeah, was that, is that a Turkish thing?
Yeah, that's Turkish, that's right. Pintar, yeah. And that money they would collect it and give it to the poor or to the temple.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Charity, you know.
Let's see, most of the music they sang, was it a... Was it mostly Turkish and Greek, or was it mostly
Turkish, Greek,
Spanish?
And Spanish.
Spanish all
too.
Of that.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Now we'll come over to the United States, and let's see. Your mother came over, and she had relatives. She had an uncle or something, a brother or sister
no,
here before that time.
Here, I had two brothers before we came. So they came in 1910.
And where were
New
they?
York.
New York.
In the east side, New York. You mm-hmm. know. And then they sent us money. And then my mother, she borrowed money from her brother in New York, my uncle. So she got all the money together. So she and I and my little brother, still in arms, you know. So we came to New York. And then she saved some more money. Then 2 years later, then the rest of the family brought over.
To New York? And how long did you live in New York before coming to
About
Long?
4 years. And then we went to Seattle. I had a sister there.
I see.
She's a sister that one of these picture prize, you know?
Yeah.
So she, was getting kind of worried about, you know, she was in her 20s and no suitor, you know, no boyfriend. Because the boyfriend wanted money. She didn't have it. We didn't have any money. So through this picture bride deal, she met somebody in Seattle, and she went to Seattle, and they raised a family, and they got along just beautifully, famously.
How long did you live in Seattle, man?
I lived there for about 10 years.
That's awesome.
I was there now, I got there 1918, then I was there till about 1930.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
About 1930?
About 12 years.
How many families would you say were in Seattle when you first got there, around 1918? Approximately?
Not too many. I would say maybe 100 families, something like that. It wasn't very large.
Okay, now this is some stuff that you may know from just from a little bit of your traveling around recently. I'm going to be traveling in my car around to the other parts of the United States and stuff this summer. I was wondering, I know we have some relatives in Atlanta, Georgia.
Montgomery, Alabama, they have there a Keilah, you know, a synagogue made up practically of people that came from Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
If you go there, you'd be just like feeling right at home. You're not going to be surprised if you have some relatives there, on mother's side, father's side.
Yeah.
They're because in Rhodes, everybody was, if you get to be second cousin, you're a stranger. I mean, you're not related. But here, you know, he's my second cousin, big deal. And over there, because, you know, there was intermarriage among the closer relations there, because it was a closely knit community, see?
Uh-huh.
And I brought out another article that whenever a girl left Rhodes to come to the United States, you know, it was like a catastrophe in a way, because chances of seeing her again, very remote, you know, once they go to America, God knows if you're going to see him. So, except that she was going to go there, and she was going to get married, and settle down, that was the only consolation for the family.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, just like she's going never to come back again.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if there were... do you know what other cities there's some Rhodes cities? I know
Montgomery, by all means. Montgomery, you have to go on Atlanta, Georgia. There you see the Francos and so on. in Montgomery, Alabama. As a matter of fact, last week I called up the temple, you know, the Sephardic temple there in Montgomery, uh-huh. and I was talking to a Dr. Morris Capuya.
Uh-huh.
I think he spelled his name with a C, C-A-P-U-Y-A. Yeah. He's a dentist and he is a chairman of the religious committee of the temple, and he was born in Rhodes. Yeah. So if you go there, just think of Dr. Morris Capuya. Dentist, a nice guy.
Okay.
And then I know he's going to extend you all the help, you know, about the community, because he's intelligent and he's one of our boys, you know.
Uh-huh.
And of course, in New York, they have also Sephardic, I mean, congregation there.
Are there very many Rhodes leaves there?
Rhodes leave, quite a few.
Really?
Quite a few, but you can easily find out if you look under Sephardic synagogues or temples, and you call one and tell them, by the way, I'd like to get in touch with some of the Sephardic Rhodes from Rhodes, and they'll tell you. Especially in the east side of town, they used to be there, I don't know if they changed, but it shouldn't be difficult.
Well, they have a community?
Yeah, they have a community, but I don't think they have they never had a synagogue.
Oh, really?
On high holidays, they would rent a hall.
Uh-huh.
They would rent a hall for, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. But the rest of the year, I don't think they, and then if they had any celebration, anything would be in the homes, you know, like Bar Mitzvah or Agadah, you know, the Seder and so on, so mm-hmm. they have in their homes.
Hmm.
But the high holidays, they would rent.
Do you know if there's anybody in Chicago? Or
no, I don't think so. In Chicago, there are some Sephardim, but not from Rhodes.
Uh-huh.
Portland, Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And then there may be some in Minneapolis and Detroit, those places, but smaller communities.
Really? Detroit,
yeah.
maybe?
Yeah, but if you ask this Dr. Morris Capuya in Montgomery,
uh-huh.
he'll tell you, because he's in that area, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so
right.
He may tell you, but those are the important ones. Montgomery, Atlanta, Seattle, even San Francisco has some, but not too many.
Uh-huh.